Washington Money. My name is Allison Coulot, and I'm happy to be here with you today on Memorial Day. Coming up this morning, we're going to revisit a few interviews that took place earlier this year. We'll begin with revisiting an interview exploring the rise of shareholder activism with Rahul Menon. He's the assistant professor of management at the Krannert School of Management at Purdue University. Mountain Money will then explore Metropolitan Theaters Corporation declaration of bankruptcy with Thomas Beckett. An interview with Reno Vanzo with the Boob Bus will take place at the end of the hour, highlighting their mammogram, genetic testing, and cosmetic procedures on wheels. We've got all this and much more on Mountain Money this morning. Stay tuned. We'll be right back after this. Welcome back to Mountain Money. This interview was recorded and previously aired on April 1st of 2024.
Well, my Facebook feed recently had something I had never seen before. It was an animated ad promoting an upcoming Disney shareholder vote and encouraging me to vote now for Disney's 12 director nominees. Well, I supposed I shouldn't have been surprised that it was animated given that it was Disney, but what was surprising was that I am not a significant Disney shareholder. So what's going on in the House of Mouse that is driving this unusual campaign? And what are the goals of and strategies deployed by activist shareholders in the modern corporate world? We're lucky to be joined this morning by Professor Rahul Menon of the Daniels School of Business at Purdue University, who has researched and written extensively on the topic. Good morning, Professor Menon, and welcome to Mountain Money.
Hi, good morning, Allison and Roger. Thanks for having me on this show.
Professor, let's start with some corporate governance basics, the way they draw it up on the blackboard in law school. What is the relationship between shareholders, boards, and management supposed to work in theory, and what's the reality?
All right, so let's start with the theory on shareholders, board, and management, right? So shareholders are the owners of the firm, but we know ownership is dispersed, so shareholders are not managing or running the day-to-day operations of the firm. That's where the management comes in, so they are the agents acting on behalf of these owners and trying to run the operations of the firm to maximize shareholder value. But then how do you ensure that these agents are acting in the best interest of the shareholder? So the shareholders therefore elect the board of directors who are supposed to oversee the management, set their compensation, and replace any non-performing executives. So that's the theory. But in practice, what may happen is that boards may not always be acting in the best interest of shareholders. This might not be intentional, it's just that the board members might be busy people, they might be serving on multiple boards, they might be the CEOs or CFOs of other public firms, and so they might not have the bandwidth to ensure proper oversight of management. And it's also possible that the board over time develops a good relationship with management. And so in those cases, they might be more biased towards the management's point of view on matters. So that's the reality, and that's where you have these activist shareholders come in.
So what's the profile of the typical activist investor, and what's their motivation?
So a typical activist investor is an institutional investor. So probably a manager of a hedge fund that, say, manages billions of dollars of assets. And they are, the way I think of it is the regular investor invests in the firm because they believe in the firm and they believe that the firm is going to do well. The activists invest in a firm because they believe the firm is not doing something right. And so they want to come in and kind of shake things up. So that's what the typical activist investor would look like.
So a hedge fund, let's say a hedge fund has a substantial position in a publicly traded company. Obviously, mm-hmm. if they think it's not doing things right, one possibility is they could just sell their stake, right?
Yes.
But they're taking it, but these people obviously believe that there is a better path for them. That
yes.
by taking some steps, they can actually increase shareholder stock price, right? Because that's at the end of the day, I assume all hedge funds care about a stock price. Have I got that right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, they care about it. So the typical activist would target a company with some core valuable assets, a strong business, but they feel that the company's underperforming its peers in terms of earnings or valuation, total shareholder returns. And so their objective is that, well, the company is maybe not undervalued or underpriced, it's just that their value can be increased. And so I'm going to step in and I'm going to take some steps, maybe cut costs, make operations more efficient, change executive compensation, and stuff like that to ensure that the valuation of the company improves.
And I want to ask if this ever works. I mean, can you think of some examples that our audience might understand where an activist shareholder has aggressively pursued something, and I want you to explain what the something would be, whether it's a change in management, a change in the board, what the options are, but where an activist investor has pursued something that caused a positive change?
So, I mean, there are quite a few examples, right? So a lot of times the changes might not be very visible, but if you go back to like 2013, Carl Icahn targeted Apple. And at that time, Apple was sitting on this huge pile of cash, but they didn't have a policy of paying dividends. So Icahn said that it's ridiculous that they're sitting on so much cash, they're not returning that to shareholders. So he stepped in, he took a 1% stake in Apple and kind of had talks with the management, with Tim Cook, to instate a dividend policy and a share buyback policy. And so since then, I mean, Apple has installed this policy of paying dividends, engaging in share buybacks. And now I think they return close to $100 billion a year through buybacks and dividends. And one of the consequences of that was that Apple's PE multiples significantly improved. It got some value investors like Warren Buffett, who likes to invest in stocks that pay regular dividends. And so there are a lot of examples like this. For instance, recently Nelson Peltz targeted Unilever and forced them to they kind of edged them to spin off one of their divisions, the ice cream business that sells Ben and Jerry's, and also engage in some cost-cutting measures. So there are quite a few examples where activists do come in and bring real change. It could also be a change in management, so forcing succession of CEO, bringing in a new CEO with a different perspective.
Now, Icahn is a serial activist, right? He's been doing this for as long as I can remember. And just to sort of finish out the story, so Icahn comes in, he buys 1% of Apple, he wreaks these changes. Does he then sort of sell his stake off and take some profits out of it, or does he stay involved with the company?
So the activist strategies might vary. So I think in the case of Icahn, he exited his stake in 2016. Mm-hmm. But for different reasons. So I think he was not sure about Apple's strategy in China. Sometimes activists, if they take a board seat, might stick on longer for like 6 years, 7 years. But at some point, they would like to exit their stake so that they can target another firm.
You mentioned, you know, the case with Apple being in 2013. Are activist shareholders something new? Because it definitely feels like there's a lot about it in the news today.
Yeah, I do agree. I mean, activism is not new. I mean, there have been corporate raiders since the 80s who kind of target firms, cause the firm to either go for a merger or be taken over by another firm. And so it goes back quite to the 80s, but definitely it has been increasing. Over the past decade or so, we have seen a significant rise in shareholder activism and a lot more campaigns targeting some of the even large firms.
Yeah, I suppose we can think back to Wall Street and when the Michael Douglas character targets Blue Star Airlines as an 80s activist shareholder move.
Yes.
How does an activist shareholder campaign typically begin?
So the campaign would begin with accumulating a significant stake in a company. For a small company, it might be over 5%, but for a large company like, say, Procter & Gamble or Unilever or Apple, it might be somewhere around 1-1.5%. So you accumulate the stake, and then you kind of begin talks with management. So it starts with a formal communication of what the activist demands are. So what do you want? Do you want the company to spin off a certain division or to cut costs, increase the dividends? So you communicate that. And then, of course, it goes from there. The management might accept some of the demands, might reject them, in which case you might go for the next step, which is asking for a board seat. If that gets rejected, then you get to like the more aggressive stage, which is like a proxy contest or a proxy fight, to kind of get the vote to shareholders and let them decide whether the activists should have a board seat.
And is it fair to say that if you reach the point where you're reaching out to other shareholders, management and the activists are not agreeing?
Yes. So that's when typically, right? So that's when you would want to take it public. So you might start off with taking your demands public to kind of pressure the management. So then the management might sometimes relent and say, okay, I will agree to these demands. But if the management still doesn't relent, then you get into the proxy fight where now shareholders will vote on who gets to be on the board.
You know, intuitively, when you hear that somebody takes a stake of 1%, that doesn't strike you as being enough to create any interest in management to sort of pay attention to you. But it's really the threat of what you're going to do if they don't that causes the dialogue, isn't it, Professor?
Yes. So these activists, I mean, they're big players. They kind of go public with their demands. So they have communication specialists, advisors, proxy solicitors, and so they can kind of pressure the management by saying that, well, if you don't agree to what we're saying, we are going to make this a public battle, and then you're going to have to invest a lot of resources defending yourself in this battle. And so, as I said, I mean, right, the proxy contest, which is typically the last stage of an activist campaign, can be very expensive, not just for the activists, but also for the firm's management, because it's a lot of time spent defending your strategy. And so it goes into millions of dollars when you get to that stage.
And again, is there an example that we can point to that our listeners would understand of a famous proxy battle over the last 10 years that in a public company that actually ended up with a change in management?
So when Nelson Peltz, actually from Trion Partners, he had a big proxy battle with Procter & Gamble, which he won, actually. So that was, I'm not sure if that led to a change in management at that time, but definitely there was some succession plan that was put in place for a new CEO. But that's one of the examples that come to mind of a recent proxy battle that the activist won. And these proxy battles can go either way, so it's a 50-50 chance that the activist wins the proxy battle versus the management winning the proxy battle. And the other thing is that these are not very common because it's so costly. You would typically be able to negotiate or settle before it gets to the proxy contest stage. But there are definitely a lot of cases of activist campaigns where you end with a change in management.
As we've gone through, the proxy vote is towards the end, and definitely it's more of a hostile technique. Can you discuss a few non-hostile techniques that have proven effective for investors who are interested in promoting real change?
So, as I said, I mean, most activist campaigns start off as non-hostile because it's the less expensive route for the activist to take. Only one in maybe 10 campaigns actually get to the proxy contest stage. So the activists typically would start with a formal communication with the firm's management. And a lot of times management might be willing to listen to what the activist is saying. For instance, in the Icon Apple example that I mentioned, it didn't really have to get to a proxy contest stage because Apple CEO Tim Cook agreed with what the activist was saying and decided to instate a dividend policy. Similarly, at Unilever, didn't get to a proxy contest stage because the company agreed to the activist demands. Gave the activist a board seat, and then recently they decided to spin off their ice cream business because they thought that it was better off managed as a standalone business. And so it is pretty common that most campaigns are not the hostile type where you get to the proxy contest.
And you're right, and you talk about management disclosure strategies in sort of this non-hostile environment. Can you explain a little bit about, you know, what management can do to try to avoid a hostile fight?
Yes. So what when you come to these campaigns, activist campaigns, what the madman says is very important. Even before the activist initiates a campaign, and in particular, during the period of the campaign, right? Any statement that the firm issues about their strategy is going to be publicly challenged. And so communication with investors and the media becomes very important in the middle of the campaign so that you can make them understand what the management's point of view is. And in addition, so regular communication with investors and analysts to ensure that they're on board with the management's view and the management strategy helps the management when it comes to a proxy contest. Right? So if I'm someone who doesn't really communicate with my investors, then investors are less inclined to believe me when I'm in the middle of a proxy contest. And so regular communication, even before the campaign, becomes very, very important. And so most of the large firms typically have what are known as firms that specialize in activism defense. So you have law firms, you have investment advisory firms, and these firms will advise you on how to defend yourself against an activist. So what to say, what strategies to promote to investors, how to increase your outreach so that maximum investors are inclined to support the management.
So we started off the segment with Roger talking about the ads he's seen with regards to Disney shareholders. Mm-hmm. What is going on at Disney?
So what's happening at Disney is that Disney has been targeted by two activist investor groups. So there's Trine Partners and Black Quills Capital. So both these activist groups have complained that Disney has had lackluster performance over the past few years relative to peers in terms of profitability, earnings per share, price to earnings multiples, and shareholder returns. And so these two groups of activist investors, both Trian Partners and Black Quills Capital, they believe that they have better plans to improve the profitability of Disney. And as you can see, that this particular campaign has reached the proxy contest stage where Trian Partners and Black Quills Capital have both proposed their own nominees for the board of directors. And so with Trian, they're saying that, well, Disney needs a proper succession planning, which they don't currently have. The board doesn't have enough bandwidth to oversee the management. The half of the board are CEOs at other firms. They're not really in a position to oversee Disney. I want to improve margins of the direct-to-consumer business because they're currently low relative to peers like Netflix. And similarly, on the other hand, Black Quills Capital is saying that, well, Disney is a sum of three different businesses. You have entertainment, experiences, direct-to-consumer, and so it's better off managed as two or three separate companies.
So we got, but, go ahead.
Yes.
Sorry, no, go ahead.
But what we are seeing is that the board and the management has not agreed to these activist demands, which is why we are at this current stage.
So this sounds really complicated to me. If we have two different activist groups, are they each proposing their own slate of additional directors? And how would someone win? I'm really confused.
So each has their own slate of directors. So now there are 12 directors up for election. Disney has its own slate of 12 directors. Trian has proposed two directors that are not in that slate. So they are okay with 10 of those 12. They're not okay with two. And so they are suggesting to shareholders that they vote for Trian's two directors instead of the two that Disney has suggested. And Black Quills has its own three nominees that they would like investors to vote. So investors can vote for 12 directors. And so they can choose to vote with all of Disney's nominations or nominees. They can select Trian's nominees, or they can select Black Quills nominees. So it will depend on who gets the majority votes. So the majority will win.
I've certainly read about and have some understanding of proxy fights and how they've been done in the past. And normally, as I understand it, the efforts are dedicated toward focusing on large shareholders because they have lots of votes. You know, the Vanguards of the world, where the index fund has massive numbers of shares.
Yes, yes.
It was really interesting to me to see this thing on Facebook. Is it unusual for, you know, a company in a proxy fight to go on social media and almost randomly target people who have small, if any, shareholdings?
So that's part of the whole defense strategy. And particular case of Disney, it's all the more prominent because Disney happens to have a huge retail investor base. So Disney is a popular brand, right? So everybody has heard of it. And so unlike a lot of other firms, Disney's investor base is 40% comprised of retail investors.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And so that's a big chunk of investors who normally don't really care much about who the board is going to be, who's going to be on the board, right? And so you have to really push these investors to put in their votes. They're not going to attend the annual shareholder meeting for the most part, and a lot of them might not even mail their proxy cards. And so through this relentless media blitz, you want to kind of force these shareholders to send their proxy cards.
Yeah, I suppose like so many people, you know, if you have, you know, even a small stock portfolio, you get these proxy things in the mail, and I suppose most people just look at them and toss them in the trash.
Yes.
And
so that's why this whole campaign, like if you each company, like the company and the activists have their own websites, they have presentation materials. You have ads being run on social media, so to kind of make this big enough so that the normal retail investor takes notice and decides to put in their vote.
You know, a contest like this is really expensive, and you think about it, you know, they're trying to get like two board members or three board members. It seems like a lot of heft for, you know, a marginal sort of change in steerage of corporate governance. I guess before we go, I sort of wanted to ask you, we started out by talking about what the theory of corporate governance is. Before we go, I wanted to see if you had any observations about, you know, where there are defects in the way that corporations operate in terms of protecting shareholder interests in the current environment, what kinds of big changes, if any, would you like to see happen to sort of facilitate a more efficient sort of approach?
Yeah, so I guess that's a very
broad question. I just wanted to hear your observations.
Broad, and also a little tough question in the sense that, I mean, there's definitely, when you think of it, I mean, there's definitely, in the U.S. especially, a lot of measures taken by the SEC to protect common shareholders' interests, right? So to enhance disclosure requirements by the firm and the auditor, and then, of course, rules that enable shareholders to question the firm's management and to kind of make sure that there's enough pressure on management that they don't deviate from their fiduciary duty towards the firm's shareholders. I think one of the interesting things that happened last year was what's known as the universal proxy rule. So, because we are talking about activists, and so that's really interesting in the context of shareholder activism, is that in 2023, the SEC brought this rule where previously, when firms would email these proxy cards to shareholders to vote for the nominees, the proxy card sent by the firm would only have the firm's list of nominees. It wouldn't have any nominees proposed by an activist investor, for instance. And so a shareholder who doesn't plan on attending the shareholder meeting would have to go with either the firm's nominees or they would have to go with the activist's nominees. So they couldn't pick and choose between the two different slates of directors. But in 2023, SEC brought this universal proxy rule. And under this rule, now, when the firm mails their proxy card to investors, it must contain all nominees, both the firm's nominees as well as any dissident nominees. So in this case, in the case of Disney, it would have to contain the nominees proposed by Trian Partners and by Black Wolf Capital. And so now the investor who is mailing their proxy card back to the firm can pick and choose between the different sets of nominees, which I think is a big step in empowering the shareholder and kind of making them better equipped to put the people on the board whom they would like to see. And so I feel like policies like this or rules like this that empower the shareholder, and because the shareholder's power is to select the board, right? That's what they can do to influence the firm. And so rules are policies that allow shareholders to better pick the right people to serve on the board is what I would like to see more of from the SEC. So that's kind of like my take, right? So empowering shareholders to make this more democratic.
We appreciate your spending time with us. That's an interesting take, and I think a good one. We didn't mention that the Disney proxy fight is being waged by, once again, Nelson Peltz, who keeps popping up in these stories. Be interesting to see how it plays out.
Yeah. So he has a history of going through these proxy fights. So I think the last one he had was against Procter & Gamble, which was again a very public campaign, which he won. But he has also had some losses, I think in particular against DuPont in 2015, where his nominees lost. So it will be interesting. So the vote is on April 3rd, actually. So I'm really looking forward to the outcome of this particular contest.
Thank you, Professor Menon.
Mountain Money will be back right after this. Welcome back to Mountain Money. This interview was recorded and aired on March 18th, 2024. Since airing this interview, the Holiday Village Cinemas has closed, and the Redstone Cinemas have been acquired by Larry H. Miller Megaplex Theaters, who is promising luxury renovations during the summer of 2024. On February 29th, Metropolitan Theaters filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection. This is of great significance to Park City, as the Metropolitan owns both the Holiday Village and Redstone 8 theaters. So is Park City about to become a cinematic desert? On the phone to help us understand how Chapter 11 works and how things might play out here is bankruptcy expert Tom Beckett of Parsons Beal Law Firm. Tom, thanks for joining us this morning.
My pleasure. Nice to be on.
Let's start with some bankruptcy basics. Why would a company like this file?
This is COVID. Recall when COVID struck, the theaters shut down. And the theaters opened up within a year, but during that time, everyone got used, I think, to small screens, right? Mm-hmm. And so while other businesses have recovered better than theaters have, theaters nationwide are still about 20% below where they were before. Their leases didn't change. They still owe the same amount. For Metropolitan, it's about $2.5 million a year in rent that they pay to the entities who own the theaters. Metropolitan operates them, doesn't own the theaters. The rent stays the same. And so Metropolitan has been losing money, about $3 million in the first 9 months last year.
So they are undergoing, obviously, tremendous financial stress. We've noticed that even here, the theaters here in the Park City area don't even open in the daytime anymore. They only open in the evenings. What are the implications of filing? Let's talk about what happens when a company files for bankruptcy and how does this process proceed?
Well, the first thing that happens when a company files bankruptcy is called the automatic stay. It's an injunction against creditors harassing or suing or trying to collect from the company that files. The intent is to give we call them debtors in bankruptcy, the debtor, a breathing spell, a chance to regroup. One of the things that a debtor in bankruptcy has to do is make a decision with respect to all of its leases, whether it wants to assume those leases or reject them. It makes those decisions. The leases that are above market, it'll reject, and those that are below market, it'll assume. And that's part of its formulation of a reorganization plan. And if the creditors in the court approve its plan, then the debtor emerges as a reorganized company, either with less debt or with less lease obligations, whatever it takes to get it on its feet again.
And is it correct to assume that the theaters are likely to operate normally, at least in the short term?
Yes, for a couple of reasons. One, that's kind of the genius of Chapter 11. A Chapter 11 bankruptcy is intended so that the debtor, with its breathing spell, gets to continue the ordinary course of its business. Now, the one thing I want to point out here is that the company in Los Angeles that filed bankruptcy does not operate Redstone or Holiday. One of its subsidiaries does. And that subsidiary did not file bankruptcy. So it's like the grandfather, not the parent, of these theaters has filed bankruptcy. It makes these theaters bankruptcy adjacent. But since the operator of those theaters, these theaters in Park City, has not filed bankruptcy, there's no immediate threat that a debtor could terminate the lease or reject it.
So this is interesting. We have the solvent or non-bankrupt parent of non-bankrupt child of a bankrupt parent. That means that they're going to continue to have to pay the full rent every month, I take it, for both theaters. Why is that something that Metropolitan would be willing to continue? Why wouldn't they want to put this subsidiary into bankruptcy and get that protection?
You're making an assumption, Roger, that the lease is above market.
Ah.
We don't know that that's the case. It's safer to assume that the fewer people are going to movies. We've seen that, right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so revenue is down, but we don't know the terms of that lease, so we don't know whether it's above or below market.
So that might even explain why they made that decision. In other words, if they looked at it and said, hey, we don't mind these leases, right, therefore we're not going to file. Is that possibly how that thought process would have worked?
That's one explanation, and I will offer another one.
Sure.
In the bankruptcy case, papers say that the parent company has guaranteed the debt of the subsidiary that operates these two theaters. So if the subsidiary were to file bankruptcy, that could have a couple of effects. It would trigger the guarantee obligation of the parent, and that would substantially increase its debt. And we don't know by how much.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't want to stray into too much minutia, but one important aspect of this particular case is that it is filed under Chapter 11, but a small business provision of Chapter 11, which we call Subchapter 5. And a Subchapter 5 bankruptcy has an eligibility amount in terms of how much your debt is. It's $7.5 million. If you have more than $7.5 million in debt, you can't proceed under Subchapter 5. The parent is in Subchapter 5. And there are a number of advantages of that over a typical Chapter 11. And it could be that putting the subsidiary in increases its debt beyond its eligibility. I don't know.
So I want you to do a little role-playing game for us, Tom. We've got these different parties, and sort of talk about how the dynamics work in a typical case, not necessarily this one, between we've got creditors, we've got the equity, and I think this is a privately owned family company, and we've got leaseholders. How do these people sort of negotiate? How do they, what are each of them trying to do, and what role does the court ultimately play?
I'll start with a comment about debt and equity, if I can.
Okay.
Ordinarily, in the non-bankruptcy business world, everyone understands that the management of a company owes a fiduciary duty to the owners, the equity. That changes as a matter of law when the company becomes insolvent. And certainly, when it's officially in a bankruptcy proceeding, management then owes a fiduciary duty not to the owners, but to the creditors. In this case, you have management. It's a family-run business, Metropolitan. Management is the owners, and so they're going to have to be very careful to put the creditors' interests ahead of those of themselves. So in a typical Chapter 11, not a Subchapter 5, a branch of the Justice Department called the U.S. Trustee's Office will ask creditors if they want to form a committee. And so there's a committee of creditors, and their lawyers and their accountants and their investment bankers are paid for by the debtor. So that's pretty expensive. Mm-hmm. The idea is, instead of having a whole bunch of unsecured creditors coming in and arguing on their own behalf, you have a committee of creditors, and their fiduciary duty is not to their own claim, but to the best interests of creditors generally. So typically, those are the parties to the bankruptcy. You have the debtor and you have the committee, and they both owe their duties to the creditors generally. And together they work out a plan, solve some of the problems, and work out a plan, and then put that plan out for a vote by all the creditors. If the plan is approved, then the judge looks at the bankruptcy code and determines that the plan comports with the bankruptcy code, which is really fairly technical. And in the meantime, there are 100 different little fights that break out that the judge has to decide. In a subchapter 5, there is no committee, so the debtor is spared that expense. And instead, an individual, typically a lawyer, will act as the subchapter 5 trustee. And he or she is kind of an ombudsman who watches over everything, advises the debtor, settles disputes with creditors, and moves the debtor along to completing a plan. In a chapter 11, it can take years to confirm a plan. In a subchapter 5, the dust should pretty much have settled after 90 days. A plan has to be proposed within 90 days. So it happens much quicker.
Let's talk a little bit, just a little bit about the dynamics here, which is, I'm a creditor. I'm owed X dollars. And now we have this filing. I obviously want to get as much as I can, you know, on my debt. Is the dynamic here that if I try to get too much, the company goes under, it goes into liquidation, and I end up getting less? Is that sort of trying to walk that rubber band of tension to try to figure out what's the most I can get without causing the company to liquidate, because then I'll probably get less? Have I basically got that right?
That's exactly right. In fact, one of the tests for confirming a plan is the debtor has to show that its continued existence is better for the creditors than its immediate liquidation. And so it may be giving the creditors stock or notes or, you know, some future promise, but it needs their vote to confirm the plan. So it's got to persuade them that reorganization is better than liquidation. Otherwise, the creditors say, you know, let's get this over with. Let's pull off the Band-Aid. Let's just liquidate it. And that happens quite a lot.
Tom, are you seeing other sort of theater chains suffering similar kinds of liquidity problems in as you look around the bankruptcy world?
Yes, but I want to make a comment here. When the pandemic began, when COVID hit, a lot of people thought, oh Lordy, it's going to be bankruptcies all over the place. And instead of rising, bankruptcies fell to about 35-40% of their prior rates. Personal bankruptcies fell much faster. And business bankruptcies took about a year and a half or two to bottom out. In the last 2 years, bankruptcies have been increasing, but generally, they're still only about 70% of where they were very consistently for 4 years before COVID hit. I think my own view is that that has baked in a lot of inefficiency, and the expectation is that bankruptcies will rise back to what we call normal and then exceed normal. And theater chains may very well be part of that. And there was part of the explanation for the dearth of bankruptcies was there was so much money pumped into the system, and that money still hasn't run out.
One just side question, because you've done a really good job of describing bankruptcy with Chapter 11, but then also the subchapter 5. I like the idea that subchapter 5, they have to put a plan together within 90 days, but you've also brought up some scenarios where they may need to expand out of subchapter 5, out of the small business designation. If they were to go into just regular bankruptcy, there's no timetable. Is that correct?
It's less strict. Under a normal Chapter 11, it's 180 days to propose a plan, and not uncommonly that deadline is extended. If the deadline isn't extended, the only thing that happens is that the debtor can file a plan. Anyone can file a plan. It's the rule is only the debtor can file a plan for the first 180 days.
We've been speaking with Tom Beckett of Parsons Bailey. Tom, thanks so much for spending time with us. We may ask you to come back when this thing resolves itself. And meanwhile, we'll all be watching. Thanks, Tom.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. This interview was previously aired and recorded on March 18th, 2024. Founder Rena Vanzo wants women to head into the boob bus for their annual mammogram, get genetic testing, treat themselves to cosmetic procedures that can boost their confidence, or all of the above. Whether through private parties with besties or state health contracts supporting underserved populations, the boob bus's vision is a world where no woman misses her mammogram. Joining us this morning to talk more about this business is Rena Vanzo. Rena, thank you for joining us.
Hi, Allison. Thanks for having me.
Well, we're excited to hear about this. Let's begin. Tell us, how did the idea for the boob bus begin?
So it was about 2 years ago in the spring of 2022, and I had just turned 40 years old. So many of the women listening know that that means you should be booking your first mammogram, having that first breast cancer screening. And I did that. And I was also at an area of my life where my career was kind of in a crossroads. And I was thinking about this mammogram. I was really anxious for it because I have a number of family members with breast cancer. So I was nervous. I was seeking out kind of that support from my community and family members. What do I expect out of this? What can I be doing to prepare for it? And I realized that, wow, this would be a good business if women could actually support each other in this process. You could go somewhere that felt really welcoming and inviting, get the information you're seeking, and have that exam done that women tend to put off.
The website has a number of frequently asked questions, and my favorite was, the boob bus. Isn't that name a little unsavory? What was your response?
Yeah, it's something I knew that we had to talk about. It definitely is a name that creates a little tension. You know, this conversation is really fun, but I want to recognize that the name is not for everyone. And there are going to be some women who don't want to come to us just on that principle alone. And that's okay. But my co-founder and I, you know, early on, we had some, I would say, friendly debates about the name and talking to people in the community, talking to many of the instructors in the program I'm a part of, the Masters of Business Creation program, and people had concerns about this. So we did our due diligence, we created some surveys, we talked to a number of people, and I'm really glad that we stuck with the name because we want to combat these dire breast cancer statistics. You know, Utah is one of the third lowest states in terms of mammogram compliance. Mm-hmm. Breast cancer is the second leading cause of death among women in this nation. And we want people to be screening and talking about this. And we needed a name that really matched that kind of energy and that matches the impact that we want to have on the community. And let's face it, most people that hear the boob bus have their interest piqued, and they're going to go look it up, and they're going to talk about it. And that transcends genders, by the way. Men men are looking it up too, and I think that's
probably a for
good
a different
thing,
agenda.
You know?
But that's neither here nor there.
Hey, that may be, but at least they get in the door, and then they're thinking about it. I mean, we had an event. It was at the Utah Grizzlies Fight Cancer Weekend a month ago, and I had two or three men walk on the bus and say, "Hey, can my wife come in here and do a mammogram?" And so it also just seems more approachable and more friendly than, you know, mammomobile or mammograms on wheels. I mean, those things are unoriginal. And so I think this really does invite people into the conversation, and that's exactly what we want.
You described your own situation when you went to go for your mammogram, and you have built the Boob Bus to provide a complimentary services. Can you talk about what services you provide and why you chose those?
Yeah, absolutely. The mammogram is standard. It's a specialized x-ray that every single woman should be getting yearly after she turns 40. And that's regardless of the result each year. You know, you gotta go every single year. That's the best way to detect breast cancer when it's in the early stages while it's most treatable. So we wanted to create that environment for that purpose. But something I don't think the community is talking enough about is the fact that almost half of women have something called dense breast tissue. It's abbreviated DBT. And there are four categories, type A, B, C, or D. It has nothing to do with a woman's cup size, the shape of her breasts, how they look, how they feel. It simply has to do with the number of glands and fibers and fat nodules in her breast tissue. And this is genetically driven. And the important thing is, when a woman has dense breast tissue, which is type C or D, mammograms cannot see all of the concerning findings that can be cancerous, that can become cancerous. And so this is now in women's mammogram reports. And I had that experience. I had my first mammogram, you know, a couple of weeks later, I get this letter in the mail that says, you know, nothing was seen, but the sensitivity of the mammogram is lower because you have dense breast tissue. And I was like, What does that mean? Who do I need to talk to? What do I do now? And so it came out of left field. I wasn't expecting that. I didn't even know what that meant. And then also it left me with, well, what do I do now? What do I do next? I only knew about the mammogram. And so we have a dense breast ultrasound machine. We're actually the only bus in the nation that has both the mammogram and the dense breast ultrasound. And so women have been calling and they've been saying, oh my gosh, I've been trying so hard to get this. There are only a few other dense breast ultrasound units in Utah, you know, within hospital systems. And so they can be hard to get, they can be pricey to get. And so it is our, you know, goal to really educate women about this potential result. And then also to let them know during their mammogram, we have technology that tells the technician right then and there, which of those four types of women's tissue is, so she can add on that ultrasound. And then the radiologist has the benefit of reading both exams together and giving a more comprehensive result that brings more peace of mind to that woman.
I just have to say that prevents a second visit, which is typically what that takes.
Yes.
And that's amazing.
Yes, that's right.
As a financier, I have to ask, to what extent do you have arrangements with insurance companies for payment on these kinds of services?
And it's not just somebody who's in finance asking that. I mean, that is the first question that I get asked when women call is, do you take my insurance? And as a brand new provider, we just got the bus in February. I actually tried last year getting network contracts with all of the local and national mm-hmm. payers, but this is a very structured process. I had to have the bus first so that I could have the state credentials, the federal licenses to operate. So I've restarted that process in February. I've got applications in with those insurers, and some of them say 30 days, some of them say 120 days. So I'm unfortunately in that difficult waiting period. But I have made the business decision to go ahead and accept insurance, even though they may consider me out of network. I've been writing letters to the insurance companies for each patient I'm seeing, asking, recognizing, hey, I'm not in your network yet. That process is pending. I would like to be considered in network for Jane Doe's exams. Here's why. This is what we offer. And I've had relative success getting those requests approved. So this is a process. Some of these insurance companies will backdate my effective date to when I submitted the applications. So ultimately, I don't want payment to be a barrier for women. I mean, I have to think about what's right and what's going to work for my business, but it's also really important for me to get these customers and get these women in the door, because I am a firm believer that once they have this experience with us in this very inviting, educational, supportive environment, that, by the way, they can book with a friend, their mom, their sister, their best friend can be there in the waiting room when they come out, so women can really do this, quote, together, even though the exam itself is private. But I want to get them in the door. And I believe that once they're a client of ours, that we will continue to earn their business year over year. So that's how the mammograms are working. We are billing insurance for those. But then unfortunately, the dense breast ultrasound is not something that is being reimbursed consistently in Utah yet. There's some legislation that's hoping to change that. And some states have been successful there, but that is an out-of-pocket cost. I also offer genetic testing, saliva kits for breast and ovarian, colon, pancreatic, other cancer risk. That's my background, is in genetics. So that is a self-pay service. And some women are booking private parties for their communities, and we offer some cosmetics such as Botox, skin fillers, and those elements are also cash pay. So there is kind of this combination and diversified revenue streams coming in.
Rena, we've got about 20 seconds left. Can you let the listeners know how they can find out more about the Boob Bus?
Absolutely. They can go to www.theboobbus.com to learn more. They can also call 866-747-BOOB.
Even better. Rena Vanzo, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thanks so much, you guys.
Mountain Money airs every Monday morning at 9 a.m. We look forward to you listening next week.